Kia ora koutou, how am I? This is Machinist Therapy Hotline, and this week we will be interviewing Ken Spalding, who you will meet very shortly. This is episode 11, and of course we have the dream team, Tony Closer.
Sure as shit, this is Antonia.
Shane Paul.
Hola.
Albert Radzinski.
Yeah, guest starring from Virginia today.
What? And me, Jody Tuckwell. So, without further ado, let's get on with the podcast.
Now we're Welcome,
everyone. It's episode 11, and we have on our show possibly one of the world's greatest bladesmithers. Also, he could be in contention against Bob Harrow or Mott Huffman for the BMX super guru. It is, of course, Ken Spalding.
Oh, yeah, nice. What's
up,
guys? At least he didn't throw out there Hugo Gonzalez from Team Skyway, did he?
Oh, shit, man.
You've been doing some research, or some homework there, Jody? Were you on BMX?
Oh, man, I'm just up with the play with the BMX teams. Jeez, bro.
Oh, damn.
Oh, whatever.
Oh, man, when you're talking about people like Mott Huffman, and he did, like, the first ever televised, like, 900, and then he did the first televised 900 no-handed, I mean, jeez, man, you don't know your BMXing if you don't know this shit.
This is true.
What kind of stats website do you have open right now?
I don't need stats, my friends. Hey, and if you don't know who Bob Harrow is, then, well, fuck, man. Like, I don't know where you've been in all your life, because he almost invented BMX freestyle.
Okay, so I got a question before we start asking 10 questions. Jody, did you ever own a BMX bike?
No.
Okay, exactly.
Yeah, it's the same as. But I had BMX magazines, and even though I didn't do BMX, and I bought surfing magazines, even though I was never really good at surfing.
Okay, so who here tonight has had a BMX bike? Albert?
No, unfortunately not.
Shane?
I wasn't cool enough.
Yeah, we used to, there was like an empty lot by my house, and we would build like dirt jumps out there and stuff.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough that when we left Indiana, we moved to California, and there was a BMX track out here in Windsor, California, and we started riding that, and then we went to Santa Rosa and watched Team Skyway, and those guys come in and do their stunts in a back alley behind some BMX shop, and it was pretty impressive, and I was hooked ever since, so. Sorry, Jody, you couldn't experience that.
Well, I didn't say I have never been on a BMX. I just never own my own BMX.
Well, there's some dude from your freaking country that was like, shit, Ken knows more than me, but he's the one that was working on the freaking triple backflip or some shit forever out there on the hills and the grass and finally nailed it.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys down in, like, Australia, down in that area that do a lot of pretty wild stuff.
Yeah, I remember seeing it on TV, and he tried, and freaking finally nailed it. But it's like life or death. You either make it or you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not so very forgiving.
Tony, do your dirt bike wheelie skis or skills?
What the hell?
Now, man, you're just taking me to the next level there, Shane. I can't do wheelie keys, but I can do wheelies.
I've had a couple beers.
Okay, so yes, go ahead.
I was saying, to your wheelie skills transfer to BMX from dirt bike.
Your wheelie skills? What the hell has your wheelie skills got to do with doing a wheelie?
Well, yes. Boomer, you are right. I did start out with wheelies on BMX, and I have pictures, so I'll have to dig those up and post one later on our
site. Yeah, you should do that.
I'll do it.
That's good. So anyhow, I don't know if you guys have noticed. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but Ken's involved in this interview, and as much as you probably want to talk about your willy skills, you know, I think we should concentrate on Ken.
Yes, yeah, I want to see how big Tony's willy is.
What?
Wow!
Wow! He's coming in big.
Yeah, nice to meet you there. I think he's coming in small, but whatever.
Whoa! Shots fired. So, Ken. So, for those of you that don't know you, why don't you give us a brief lowdown of who you are, what you're about, and what you're into?
Yeah.
So, kind of got the whole start with BMX. I don't ride, unfortunately, as much as I'd like to anymore. Occasional Saturdays here and there with the guys that are all working and don't ride that much either. But got the whole start with that. I live in Southern California. I'm in Anaheim, like half a mile from Disneyland now. But we had the tracks, Orange Y and all the big famous BMX tracks around here. So we rode a lot when we were elementary school, high school and all that. And couldn't really ever afford any of the parts and all that. So we started figuring out how to make stuff. You know, we were making little pedal guards out of pieces of Lexan from Home Depot and washers out of coins and punching holes in those things with, some screwdrivers and a hammer kind of thing. And then got into high school, met a couple guys. We started riding more. And then pretty much just spent my whole time riding BMX, not doing homework, not doing really any schoolwork, and started getting behind on grades and credits and everything. And they asked me if I wanted to take any after school classes, and ended up finding out that they had a drafting class. So I signed up for the drafting class because I was pretty familiar with that. My parents had a cabinet shop doing like interior millwork, high-end woodwork, for probably 30 or so years. So I was already doing drafting and stuff that with them when I was young. And kind of figured it was just going to be a drafting class with a pencil and a drafting table and get into the classroom and sit at the big drafting tables. And teacher kind of looks at me like, what the hell are you doing, man? This is a CAD class. So ended up taking CAD and started doing that probably my sophomore or junior or so year in high school. And then went from there. My auto shop teacher saw some of those drawings and asked if I wanted to figure out, going to a machine shop class. And started taking machining, manual machining, and then kind of from there, it just snowballed to where it's at now. So that's like a introduction to me or what, but so.
Yeah, well, certainly from an Instagram perspective, you've been there from almost the beginning. And I think most of us have followed you for so many years and mm-hmm. have always been in awe of the stuff that you've been putting on. It's, I mean, how have you found, using Instagram as a tool? I mean, is that something you were doing, or are you just posting it because it was just cool?
I think a little bit of everything, really. I mean, it started off just posting some pictures of bike parts that I was making in my house. I had a little engine lathe and a little manual mill in my apartment, and I was just making hub guards and just little stuff, and I was posting about it. And I think a lot of the early followers, like everybody, was probably just their close friends. There wasn't really any kind of instant machinist group or anything yet. It was still pretty early.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it was really just kind of showing the stuff that I was into, and then started seeing more machinists on there, and then everybody started talking. And I mean, I pretty much followed you guys since the beginning too, I think.
So how many jobs have you had as far as, just being a machinist? How many spots have you been in?
How many shops have I worked at?
Yeah.
I've been at 3, and then I had my own for a few years too. So the first shop, like when I got out of high school, I got offered a job. So one of my buddies that rode BMX, his dad had a shop, big aerospace shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we're out riding BMX one day, and I'm out just building some dirt jumps. I get a call from a number I don't know, and it was his brother, who was the general manager at the time. He's like, hey, I hear you're taking machine shop class. You know, you have an interest in this. You speak English. You want a job? And I was like, fuck, sure. He's like, all right, when can you start? I'm like, tomorrow? Okay, see you then. And I was there for 5 years, and that was a pretty, pretty solid shop. Everything, all the machines there were Mori's. We had one star, Swiss.
Mm-hmm.
But all the mills, all the lays were all Mori's. We had a lot of gear equipment, gear shapers, grinders, cylindrical grinders. So there was a, it was a pretty good mix of different machines and different experience there. And then I don't really know all the details of why things kind of went south there with the company itself, but they ended up selling, and a lot of employees got let go. So I was there, and I kind of saw it was coming and started interviewing at other shops in the area. And then I already had a couple interviews with one shop that was not too far. And so as soon as they let me know, I was like, all right, cool. And I just went straight to that other shop and started working right away. And that shop there, that was the second shop that I was at. They did primarily vacuum form molds. So we did just big vacuum form trays for like external hard drives for Seagate, Western Digital. A lot of retail packaging. So we didn't do any of the production forming in-house, but we did all the prototyping and all of the CAD, all the CAM, using CATIA and SurfCAM. Mm. So we did a lot of real complex surfacing, and but we were on old, pretty clapped out Fidals, which is where I ended up getting my Fidal from. So I worked there for about 5 years. I bought one of the Fidals from them. It was that EMC that I had. And started getting some work primarily through Instagram. So like when I had my shop, pretty much all of my work was from people on Instagram, just word of mouth or people seeing stuff. Hey, I want to get some sprockets made, or hey, I want to get just, you know, random stuff. It was before I was in knives and doing all that. Most of it was BMX work. So I started doing a bunch of that. And then I got a pretty big order from a knife company and told work, you know, there was some stuff going on at work anyways, like business was great and everything, but just, you know, working so close to some people sometimes is kind of tough. Every single day, you know, you spend more time with the people at work than at home.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I kind of told him, hey, things are picking up at my shop. I already had my shop space and machine there and everything. I moved all my machines out of the house, got a little spot with my brother, and told him, hey, this is, you know, things are great here. I like it, but things are better at my shop. And, you know, it was either, you know, working there full time, then my shop full time at night, then coming home and trying to hang with my wife. And it gets tough. I mean, you guys know how that goes. And one, you know, one of those things had to go, and I wasn't about to lose her or my shop. So I took off and started doing my thing, just full time. And all my work, almost all of it was coming through Instagram.
Wow.
So it was pretty cool. Yeah.
That was very cool. So, I mean, where was the transition point from, you know, few BMX parts to suddenly becoming a bladesmith, you know, or, a, you know,
is that the right terminology?
Is that?
I don't know. A lot of guys say knife makers and stuff. Okay. I mean, I don't really do it too. So really a lot of the stuff that I've ever made is really just kind of stemmed from stuff that I've been into, you know, making bike parts because I ride BMX, doing some firearm stuff because I'm into the mechanics of firearms. I don't really shoot that much anymore, but I still have stuff, and I like messing with it and fitting and, you know, getting the mechanics of it to work. It's pretty rewarding. So I started getting into that, and then I've always carried pocket knives since I was little. And then I had a customer that wanted to get some knife stuff done, and that was really kind of where it all started. So we were just working late nights, getting some prototype knife stuff done, and it just kind of snowballed from there. Started doing some of my own designs and then making more for other people and doing parts for this guy and that guy, again, all through Instagram. So it was pretty cool.
Are you primarily
doing like job shop type stuff now, or?
Well, now I had my shop up until 2 years ago. There was a couple guys at the shop. Things went south with them. And I basically just told them, hey, I'm out of here. I'm not going to deal with this crap anymore. It's bullshit. So I moved out of my shop, and my buddy that actually got me that job at the first shop that I still ride with, at his dad's shop, he actually works at the shop that I work at now. So he helped me move a lot of my machines out of my shop, and ended up telling his dad, hey, he's moving, you know, call him, see what's going on with him. So I got a call with him. He's like, hey, don't sign another lease anywhere. You know, I know business is good, everything's cool, but just come talk to us. So I said, all right, sure. So I went there. This was on a Thursday. He called me. I went over there on Friday and interviewed with the CEO and everybody else. And I started on the following Monday, and I've been there for like 2.5 years now.
Wow.
So I'm just working. Yeah. So I'm working full time there now. I had a lot of my machines in storage for a while because we lived in a pretty small spot. We didn't really have room for equipment or power. And then about a little over a year ago, my wife and I moved into a house when she got pregnant. We're like, we need to get a bigger spot. So we started looking around over here in Anaheim. And I found a house with a huge garage. And it was already wired up. Everything was good. So we moved in here and I pulled a lot of my stuff out of storage and kind of just started doing things again. But before that, when I had my machines in storage, Lockwood, Rob Lockwood hit me up. He's like, hey, you know anybody with a Fidal for sale? And I said, sure, take mine. You know, we worked out a deal. And so now my old Fidal is up at his house in his garage. And then I got a couple buddies locally, Joe at Random Fabrication. He started getting into machining past few years. So me and him and a couple other guys, we've kind of just been trading machines and getting something. And, hey, this would be better for you, you know, and we just kind of pass things around. And so he ended up buying a Fidal within the last year. And then I ended up getting his old Toyosiki mill from him. So that's what I've got in the garage now. It's a 1989 Toyosiki with an old Fanuc control. Pretty limited, but I think it's actually been pretty sweet having this old, really limited machine, because I think it's gotten me a lot more conscious of code, just programming in general.
Yeah.
You know, I'm primarily on Fusion, and if any of you guys have used that or anybody listening knows that it's pretty solid, but some of the code that spits out, unless you have your post really dialed, you get a lot of extra crap in there, which works fine if you have the memory, but my machine's only 32K, so there's not a whole lot of room. Yeah, it's pretty limited. So I feel like I've had a, you know, pretty good requirement for getting really comfy with sub programs and just really dialing in, getting real clean code. So I've actually enjoyed it. It's been pretty cool, because I know on the Fidal when I had that, I never gave a shit what got posted out, as long as the parts ran.
You know, right.
You know, it's tough going on the control and actually making a change when you have 15,000 lines of code, you know.
Yeah.
For one tool, so. You know,
The mill you have now, what kind of control was it?
It's a Fanuc 0M. It's not a Fanuc or any of that other.
Yeah, it's a Fanuc. Oh, Tony.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. Yeah. Every episode that I've listened to, I've always answered like all the questions on my own too, and so it's cool being able to chime in now a little bit, you know. It's fucking Fanuc, dude, you know.
So. Hey Ken, when I remember, like, I came to your shop a few years back, which was really cool, man, like to meet you. And I remember though, at the time there was things were not quite right, you know, like everything just, there was that sort of atmosphere in your shop. And as you said, you obviously then sort of parted ways. I mean, that must have been pretty difficult.
Sucked. It sucked out. For sure, you know, because, you know those guys, and Tony's met or talked to one of them.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you guys know, you know. And so, yeah, it was tough, you know, because I had that shop with my brother originally. We had just a small space. It was our first shop where I brought my Fidal to and all my manual stuff. And kind of building that shop from nothing, my brother does automotive stuff. So we are kind of completely different in one space. So that in itself was already kind of tough. But then, you know, he came over and things were cool. And then my brother and I got a bigger shop. So we moved into a bigger shop. I had a lot more space. And then that guy started bringing some tools over, which was cool. But then they just kind of overstayed welcome, you know. But at the end of our lease from our big shop, I was at the point where my brother was going to get his own space, because he painted cars. He does a lot of automotive stuff. So the paint was getting on machines, no matter how much we tried to contain it with the booths and tarps and whatever else, it's impossible.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting my own spot, with a buddy of mine, Joe at Random Fab. We got a spot over there. And then those guys ended up coming over too, you know, hey, we want to keep doing stuff together. I'm like, I want my own spot. I don't want to deal with this crap anymore. You know, it was already kind of getting irritating. But still, you know, I like those guys. I wanted things to work out. And then we ended up all kind of going in together. It was my lease and Joe's lease, and that was it. And those guys were paying cash each month to be there. But then I was doing work for both of them, and one of them ended up basically conning the other one into becoming business partners. And he was basically just trying to run the whole shop, even all of my stuff, which had nothing to do with him. I found out he was contacting my customers and telling them, hey, this guy's not working on your stuff, not knowing that certain jobs were on hold because the customer had revisions and so on. So he was basically just going out of his way to try and take the work out from under me because he saw how things were running. You know, work was good, money was good. But he was basically just weaseling his way for some deposits and never fulfilled anything. Wow. And I just ended up telling him, hey, you guys got to go. This is affecting my business now. I can't have this anymore. You know, you guys are, even the neighbors were complaining about them. I found out that they were sleeping in the shop at night after they were specifically told not to do that. You know, claiming that that was their second shift and all this other, it was just all bullshit. And, I told him, hey, you guys got to go. Management doesn't want you guys here either. The lease is up in 30 days, so you're either out or I'm out, and the shop's gone anyways. And they refused to leave, so the end of the lease, Joe and I, we both took off. Those guys ended up staying, and then Joe got an attorney, served them with a 30-day notice. They didn't leave, and then they got served with an eviction. So that was why they ultimately moved back to L.A. where they were at now. Wow. And I found out since that one of them the other guy was actually screwed by the other one, so... Now he's lost all of his shit because he stuck around too long and just basically got bled dry.
Who would have guessed?
Yeah, I told him too. I'm like, dude, this is not gonna work out for any of us, you know. So let's either make this work, or I'm out, you know. Wow. And they weren't having it, so I said, you know what, fuck it, I'm out of here. You know, they did Kickstarters and got a ton of cash from that, and ended up thinking, oh well, we don't need you anymore for machining. Let's just buy a brother. And buy a Mori lathe that we don't know how to use. And so they bought some cool machines and threw them in my shop, you know, but they had no idea how to do any turning or even use the machine in general, you know. So I started using the lathe and told them, hey, you know, I'll use the lathe and I'll help you guys out. And then they started pulling some shit with me, and I told them, fuck it, I don't need the lathe that bad, you know. I'm not going to use it. So that you guys can tell me that I owe you something, you know? So just, I'm not going to use it anymore. Don't worry about it. I don't need it anyways. You know, things just got, they got tough. Bad. And it was even when Jody was there, you know, I mean, sure, you could see it, you know, it was just the atmosphere in the shop was toxic, and I didn't want anything to do with it, you know? So it was actually a blessing in disguise. I'm really happy that all that happened, because since then, you know, I've got the job where I'm at now, which is fucking awesome. We got a house now with my wife. I got a kid who's 9 months old. Like I can't complain about anything that happened from any of that.
Yeah.
You know, so it's actually pretty cool. You know, it was a shit situation.
Everything happens for a reason, eh? You know, like at the time it feels like, fuck, why am I having to go through all of this shit? But you know, if you can pop out the end of it and you're the better man, then you know, you are winning. And clearly you are, you know, you got to, we see the photos of your child, and it's awesome, man. Like, you seem like you're in cool. a real super happy spot.
Yeah, I'm stoked. I can't complain about anything, really. I know some of you guys met my wife too at IMTS this last year, which was cool. She was, you know, 8 months pregnant, but you know, it was cool. We had a good trip. So it's been great. You know, I can't complain about any of that stuff. You know, as much as it sucked and as shitty as it was, nothing that I did since then, none of it was required, really. You know, it wasn't like, fuck, I have to sell my machine, or fuck, I have to go get a job. You know, it was like some opportunities came up and I took them because they made sense, just for stability and financially and all that, you know. So it worked out well, but it wasn't like, fuck, I'm out on the street now, what am I going to do, you know? But overall, it worked out for the best, I think, you know, and I don't have to deal with those guys, and I don't give a shit about them, and, you know, it sucks, but whatever, you know.
I'm glad I never ended up making any parts for that dude.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's a very, very long list of people that have been screwed that still, you know.
I can imagine.
Probably would have made them, and he would have never paid. And, yeah.
I remember years ago, shit's probably been 7, 8, maybe 10 years ago, when I was down in Disneyland and I posted a couple of pics or something, and you commented on one of my pics and said, hey man, I'm like about 10-15 minutes away, come by and see the shop or something. And was it one of the roller coasters you said you made parts for at that time?
Yeah, so the first shop that I worked at was a pretty sweet shop. We did a lot of Parker stuff, a lot of like hydraulic valves and things like that.
Okay.
But we did do a lot of work for the roller coaster at California Adventure. So it was all the linkages. As far as I'm aware, it's you because you can even kind of see the parts if you look at the cars. They've probably swapped them out, you know, decades by now. But it's the linkages between the two cars. So the, it's actually the mechanism that is connecting, you know, each car to each other. And I did all the milling on that. There were huge hog outs. They were probably like a 12-inch by 12-inch cube out of some stainless. And
that's awesome.
It was a lot of work to remove all that material, but it was cool. It was a fun job, and it's cool to see that kind of stuff, you know, when you go, you know, go to Disneyland or go wherever and see stuff that you've made, you know, because now everything that we do now at the shop where I'm at now is all primarily military. We don't ever see any of that unless it's, you know, on the news blowing up some ISIS or something, which is cool.
Well, that's kind of cool too, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Oh, you can sit around and go, cool. Look, you see that tank over there? Well, I made the end of it, and that's what's blown up that building.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we do a lot of pretty cool stuff. Steering components for missiles and JDAM bombs, and it's pretty cool. It sucks because I, you know, when I had my shop, I was posting stuff, you know, almost daily, and Instagram was just going really well. And then since I got this job, it's all ITAR, and I can't post anything from there except for maybe occasional fixtures here and there. And I feel like, you know, I kind of got like left behind while everybody else is making all kinds of cool shit, and I can't post any of it. But so now it's really, I mean, mainly Instagram is just a really good networking tool, I feel like now, because I'm not doing a whole lot of work at the house. I do a little bit here and there, but most of it's for people I already know. And I don't have a whole lot of time anyways, just with the baby and everything. So now it's really just cool to just network with people. That's mainly like been the biggest benefit of it, I think, just social media in general.
I texted you recently, didn't I, about, you know, whether you were, you know, bringing out some more knives or whatever, because when I was at Ken's shop, he showed me how to flick the knife out because I had no idea how to do it. And I was there for like, oh, I don't know. Well, even within the hour I was there, I could not for the fucking life of me flick the knife out with my thumb. It was like I had some kind of disabled thumb. It was really weird. And then someone gave me a knife here, and then I must have spent a month trying to flick this thing out, because I'd either get my finger caught or it wouldn't flick out, or I'd throw it on the floor or whatever, you know. And then finally I got it out, and I sent a picture to Ken, and I was like, I did it. And he was like, yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, it's like flicking a booger off your thumb or something. You know?
Yeah, that's what you kept telling me. I was like, well, I'm doing that, but I'm throwing it on the floor.
Yeah, so I'm probably going to be doing some more stuff here at the house once I finish up a couple jobs I've got. I definitely want to make some more knives. You know, I did, when I had the shop still, I had a Kickstarter for some slingshots, and I finished up all the aluminum ones on that, but I had a small order of titanium ones that I had to get done. So that was the first thing that I did when I got the machine here, was get that all set up for that Kickstarter to finish the titanium ones. So I've been kind of selling some of the bonus stock that I had, which has been cool because it's certainly, you know, the work's already done. So I have a couple of stuff like that. I have my little 1911 bushing wrenches, the firearm tools, and a couple bike parts that I put up on the website, and occasionally I'll post some photos of it and get a couple sales, which is cool. But it's nice not having to rely on that anymore. You know, I've got the stability at work, so anything here really just kind of goes back into the garage or into the house or family. I don't have to worry about it, you know, like, aside from just keeping customers happy. It's like, if I don't want to go out in the garage for a night, I won't, you know.
Exactly.
You know, which is cool. And also, you know, when I have long cycle times, because it's at home, I can go out, get stuff set up, run it, come back in the house and just set a timer. You know, if I know I got a 20-minute cycle time, hey, I'll be back in 4 minutes. I'm going to go swap parts. You know, go out, swap some parts, come back in, put my kid to bed, go back out. You know, it's cool. It's kind of tough having the shop. I loved it. I think it was good, but right now, mainly because, you know, with my kid being so young and just working full time where I'm at, I don't really want to have another shop space. I think it would be cool, but I'd rather have just a big garage like I got right now. I think it's pretty sweet. It works out really well for the situation
more,
right now.
More of a hobbyist setup then.
Yeah, totally. Like in my garage, I've got my C10, my truck in there. I've got a bunch of other tools that I kind of work on here and there. I know there were some questions in the comments about both of those things.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
Yeah. So it's like none of it's really like hot, you know. It's not a necessity. So I'm hoping that my kid just grows up quickly and just finishes all the shit that I started and never finished. Yeah. So we'll see how it goes.
How long is the back order on a pizza cutter?
Fuck, man, I get messages all the time on those. I need to just do those. That's another thing. I just need to make some of those things, man.
That thing was badass, man.
So I made two of those. My wife's her family, they had a pizza shop in Huntington Beach. Her mm-hmm. uncle did. And so my buddy PJ, he's like, hey, let's make some pizza cutters, you know? All right, cool. So he did all the CAD work on it, sent me the files, and then we kind of tweaked on it a little bit, made two of them. And I threw his restaurant logo on one, and then I threw the other one, I just put my own logo on it and put it up for sale. And my buddy bought it right away, and then I gave the other one to her uncle, and he hung it up in his pizza shop for years. And so it was pretty cool. Every time we went over there, they sold it not too long ago, but every time we went over there, I'd always take a picture and send it to my buddy.
Yeah,
it's still up here, you know.
I remember hitting you up and saying, hey, man, when are you going to start making those? You know, as soon as I get my mill back in my garage.
Yeah. 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 So
I was going to order one.
I got that machine from my buddy. And, you know, we worked out a deal. And then like 3 days before rigging, he's like, hey, dude, the tool changer's fucked up.
Dude. Oh, Jesus.
So the whole cam gearbox just detonated inside. And so I ended up getting the machine over to my house and just tore it apart. So it was just in pieces. The whole entire tool changer was just gutted for a couple months until I got it all figured out. And, you know, this machine's from 1989, you know, so getting parts for it is impossible. Toyosiki's still around, but just getting a response from them is difficult, to say the least. So I just started making bearings and found some stuff that was close and modified a bunch of shit and got it working. And, so now it's working pretty good now. And a couple little bugs here and there. Like probably the biggest thing that sucks about it, aside from just the memory, is that it's an old Zero Mate M, and the option, there's no option for helixing. So just interpolating, you know, a thread mill is huge code for me.
Yeah.
So like if I'm doing multiple parts, I just throw that section into a sub and I just call it the subs and it works out pretty well. But, you know, if I had to do a lot of thread milling or anything, or just multiple sizes, it would be just extremely difficult, or I'd have to do it in multiple ops, which is kind of a pain in the ass. But overall, I think it's been pretty cool having that machine. You know, I kind of dig all the old clicks and all the old sounds of the boards, you know, and the contactors moving around in that old Fanuc control. It's cool. Yeah, so
you did, you said you are a fan of thread milling. When you do tapping, what kind of taps do you use?
OSG primarily, you know, whatever Western tools got. I've used probably a little bit of everything, but I've got a lot of OSG stuff. I'll do cut and roll. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's pretty good stuff, no matter what.
Yeah, I don't do a whole lot of it. But when I do, it's, you know, I'll use what I got here, or I'll get stuff from Western, and they have a lot of OSG stuff. And there's an OSG actually right down the street from us too, so it makes it really easy if I need odd sizes.
Sweet. So Hank cool. was asking what kind of coolant you ran in that mill.
Yeah, up until like a week ago, I had Qualichem in there that looked like just baby diarrhea. It was pretty disgusting.
Or horchata from the Mexican restaurant.
Yeah, it was like, definitely. Yeah, I've been fighting with this thing because I've run Qualichem for a long time. I was on Blazer before that, but I've always had kind of some skin issues and stuff with that. And but at work, we're on Qualichem, and our reps are pretty good from there. So I've always used that stuff with pretty good results. But I haven't used what you're using, so maybe I don't know any better. But up until like a couple weeks ago on this machine, for some reason, I have no idea why, the coolant was just brown. No matter how much I vacuumed it, no matter how much I cleaned it and skimmed it, it was just solid brown. So I dug into it. I ordered a skimmer, and I just gutted the whole tank and found out there's this little area right by the pump with a baffle that had like 3 inches thick of just tramp oil in there.
Oh.
And it was fucking nasty. And as soon as I got that all that crap out, you know, it's back to clean, fresh horchata again. So it's cool. That's good.
So you're still running Qualichem?
Yeah, I've got that in there now. So
cool. Hey, it works.
Yeah, I don't have any issues really. I've got good ventilation, and I don't do any through. You know, I don't have any high pressure cooling or really any high speed stuff. So I'm not worried about mist or any of that kind of stuff. I don't have any breathing issues or rust or anything on there. You know, it's always just worked out pretty well.
Cool.
So.
Stop the podcast. You still want to get involved in Machinist Therapy Hotline? Well, there's a couple of ways you can do that right now. First of all, if you know anyone that's going to Emo in Hanover, then why don't tell them to take some photos, tag us in, and use the hashtag Emo Barbecue Vest. And the best picture will win our amazing barbecue vest. Or, a bit closer to home, if you've got a shop dog, or a shop cat, or a shop pet, whatever, why not tag us in with the hashtag MTH Shop Dog? Okay, let's get on with the podcast.
Yeah, it's been pretty good.
So on the Instagram, there was a few other questions that had sort of, well, I don't know, they were very towards you, I guess. I don't know if you're one of your mates or whatever, but there was a guy on there that said, Paul Alfaro, how much longer to build the EERF, which is a blade grinder, I assume.
Yeah. So that was a project we started when I had my first shop. This was probably 6 years ago or so. Right around when I started getting into knives and started wanting to grind my own stuff, I found these files online for the EERF grinder, just free backwards. And it was a file that a guy made, and you could basically just download this file and make the parts yourself and assemble a 2x72 bell grinder. So we did that. We sent everything out to Waterjet. We got the parts back. I was all stoked on it. I tapped everything. I got it all assembled, and then, fuck, I don't have a motor. I don't have time for this. You know, I don't have wheels. I don't have whatever. But I was also starting to get into just machining all my bevels. So I didn't really have a huge need for doing, you know, belt grind on my bevels like a lot of guys do, which just kind of got me to do more machining on blades. And there's not really a whole lot of guys that are doing it. There's probably less than 10 guys that are really machining bevels. And probably even fewer that do like really clean. So I just spent a lot of time really just dialing in that process, and I never really needed the grinder. So it just kind of sat in the shop, you know, carrying it around, you know, 100-pound grinder body that just kind of got carried around everywhere. But recently I got wheels for it. I got a motor, and I'm kind of working on it here and there, just like with everything else. You know, whenever there's time or a need, I'll kind of play around with it for a little bit.
Yeah.
While I'm excited, and then I'll forget about it for 4 years.
when you say machining bevels, is that also like the chamfers?
So you've got a primary bevel on a blade, which is your main grind, main taper that leads from the thickness of your blade stock down to your edge,
and
to your sharpened edge. So that, you know, a lot of blades are either hollow ground where they have two radii, or they have just flat grinds on those.
Gotcha.
But I was just surface milling everything for a while until I started standing stuff up and just doing a trace tool path on it and just profiling them. You know, so I'll just machine soft jaws at whatever angle I need for that primary bevel. And I have a master fixture that's basically just counterbores on the top with tapped holes at the bottom, and I'll just run shoulder bolts through tabs on the blades.
Yeah.
So the blade is now fixtured up on that angle, and I can just come in with a half inch end mill and just do just a 3D path on it and just trace it, basically. Very cool. Simple, short code, and just trace it in a couple of passes. And I was getting blades down to like 2.5-3 minutes for both sides.
Wow.
Which is way faster than grinding. It's way more precise. It's way more predictable. And it comes out just really clean, especially if you're going to tumble or you're going to blast anything. You know, like the scout that you got, that was just all machine. That finish is straight off the machine. And then heat treat and some aluminum oxide and then a little bit of tumble.
Nice.
And it comes out pretty clean, you know, so there was no surface milling or anything on that. So that's kind of what I was doing, which I think set some things apart, was being able to just run blades pretty quickly and accurately, and get good finishes on stuff. You know, so it was pretty cool. You know, getting an order for like 300 blades and knocking them out pretty quickly. It was nice. Way rather do that than stand at a belt grinder all day and just do that just to say that's what you do, you know?
Yeah. And breathe kind of hear all that dust.
Yeah, you get that. There's that whole argument about, oh, no CNC, no CNC for a lot of the knife guys, where they think that they're somehow, you know, it makes them more of a knife maker because they didn't use a CNC mill, even though they used a belt grinder that has a motor with a variable frequency drive on it that controls their speed and, okay, you know, work rest and like, yeah.
Or it could be fake news and they didn't use a CNC, but they used somebody else that used the CNC.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which has actually happened before. I mean, there's guys online that say, hey, check out these blades I just made. And you can see the bench that's in the back. That's actually someone else's workbench in the shop. You know, it's like, I know that that photo was literally just sent to you from the manufacturer, you know, so yeah, they're
the thing that those guys always do that bugs me the most is like, and it's a lot of like the EDC guys too, right? Is they'll, you know, they'll crank out a bunch of things and then they'll say, you know, oh, I only got one of them. It's up for auction, you know, tomorrow or whatever. And they create like this artificial scarcity and somehow they get this hype behind them and guys just have to have it. And people pay like ridiculous amounts of money for, you know, this thing that, I mean, it's, you know, something they're never going to use. They're not going to do anything with it. It's just going to sit there and they're going to look at it and they have it and you don't.
Yeah, exactly. The industry is pretty weird. Just the knife industry and EDC stuff in general is pretty strange. I'm not super into it. I mean, I like knives. I like just making them and having them and that kind of stuff and actually using them. But the whole collector thing is just some of it gets pretty strange.
Yeah.
But that totally happens where these guys are just creating this fake, you know, scarcity, like you said, for stuff where, you know, they have a bunch more. But they'll only drop a certain amount every few months to make it seem like they're rare.
The ones that always get me are the fucking beads people make.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's
well, what do you mean? Like anal beads?
No, those are the ones I make. The ones
at least there would be some use for those, you know?
Yeah, no.
Anal beads? Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
It's just little.
Here's my everyday carry anal bead. Thank you very much.
Pull them slow until I blow.
It's made out of some type of twisted metal out of 36 different types of titanium. It's right up your butt.
I'd say my biggest complaint about those is they don't make them big enough.
Oh my God.
Albert, you say nothing for 30 minutes and that's the solution.
And then it's bigger is better.
I just thought I'd chime in about, you know, the subjects that, you know, I was well-versed on.
Yeah, you're a specialist of that, for sure. Anything is a butt plug if you're brave enough. That's
a famous quote. So one real big burning, well, hang on, one big burning question I've got is, so...
You burning? Know,
burning. Sorry. What'd you say? Sore? So, like, your Instagram name is Zodiac... ENG, what is your star sign?
Oh my God.
It had nothing to do with that, but it kind
sorry,
of
Ken.
Just so you know. Yeah. It originally had nothing to do with that. It was a couple buddies of mine that I rode BMX with, and I was making parts and they were kind of doing some of the t-shirts and that kind of stuff. So we started doing that together, but nobody really knew who was doing it. So we'd be at the skate park and somebody would have a shirt on, you know, that we did, or a sprocket that I made. And so he was like, well, this is kind of like the Zodiac Killer. There's all this crazy shit going on and nobody knows who it is.
I knew it.
You know, so he's like, let's just, So it was from that, you know? And so that's kind of where it all started. And then like ever since then, I was kind of like, I want to change the name, but it's just been, you know, everybody kind of knows it. I feel like if they know me, that's just been my handle on everything, you know? And so I just never changed it. You know, even if it hasn't really been something that I've really cared too much about for, you know, probably 15 years, but
I could see this turning out to be a pretty cool t-shirt, Zodiac Killer and Knife Maker, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Too young to
somebody needs to make a logo.
As long as someone's not wearing it while they're killing Zodiac, that would be
Yeah.
So there was another comment actually on the gram, which I thought was is really cool. There's a guy called Michael, and his handle is not a real machinist. So take from that what you will. But he said, Ken is the reason that I pursued machining. And I thought, wow, what a fucking great compliment, you know, to have from anyone, you know, like
that. For sure.
You must read that stuff and go, shit, that's awesome, you know?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I've known Mike for a long time. We met on a BMX forum. It was Bike Guide. And that forum, there's a lot of BMX forums, just a lot of bike forums in general. But that one was geared more towards like the technical aspects or the technical side of bicycles. You had like the machinists that rode. You had a lot of like the guys that worked in bike shops, techs or people that worked at companies. So it was a pretty good core group of guys, even though there was a shitload of people because it's just worldwide. But we met on there probably like 2004, roughly. And we had always just been in contact. And then we found out that we were pretty close. He's down in Carlsbad, down by San Diego. And so occasionally I would go down there. We'd all ride. They would come up here. We'd ride up here. But we've just always kept in contact.
That's cool.
And it's been pretty cool. Like, I didn't know anybody that was machinist, you know, when I was growing up. And the closest thing that I ever had was my dad's cabinet shop, you know, making just woodwork and stuff. So I'd kind of always been around tools. But as far as machining goes, I never really knew really what it was until that auto shop teacher told me, hey, that those drawings you're doing in your CAD class, you can learn how to make that stuff if you go take this machine shop class.
Yeah.
Which was pretty cool. Like, it's just kind of crazy how everything played out, you know, going from just riding BMX and not doing shit in school, getting behind, and then kind of being forced to take some extra classes to make it up. And it really just worked out really well, I think. I don't know what else I would really be doing if I wasn't doing this. It's kind of just always been what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Seems like, I mean, ever since then, you know.
BMX stuff has always been very cool. And I remember being at a young age and learning about changing the front sprocket or the back sprocket, you know, and whether you're out doing some cross country or up and down hills or certain tracks. And it was like, you know, as a kid, I had no idea that it would change things that much. And then once you take that front sprocket off and put on a smaller one or a bigger one or this, that, and the other. And then I got into motorcycles and even took it even further. But I remember the first time that I went to a BMX track and, you know, we were all kids and we were all building ramps on the streets and everything was the coolest. You skied as high as you could. The further you went, the higher you went, you were a hero. And the first BMX track that I went, I said, what the fuck are these guys doing hopping before the jump and then coasting down the backside? That's stupid. Yeah. They're not catching any air at all. But you know what? They're going a hell of a lot faster than I was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, even within the last 5 years or so, I've been to the track a couple times, and I can't keep up with anybody. Even these little kids, dude, they're fast as shit. Maybe it's just because I'm fat now, but
well, watching them come off the start gate is insane. I mean, anticipating when it's going to drop and already riding a wheelie down the freaking hill. I mean, what?
It's wild,
crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, you see a lot of kids that are trying to learn that, and the gate doesn't drop, and they flip over the gate, and then the gate, and then the gate drops on their bike, you know, crushes the front wheel.
Exactly.
I'm going to roll out of this one. Yeah.
We've got so there's a guy on there as well. He's based in New Zealand, and he makes, like, BMX parts and other mountain bike parts. The guy's name's Bruno, and his Instagram account is called CXP Racing. You know, he'd already started, said, oh, it'd be really cool to hear about your BMX days, but of course we've talked quite a bit about that already. You know, what would be your advice for somebody that wants to get into that sport? What would someone do
As far as just getting into BMX? You're talking about bikes?
Oh, everything, you know, why not? Yeah, bikes first of all.
Yeah, I mean, bikes, really, it's so easy to get into all this stuff now. I mean, with the internet, with everything else, you know, machining, just programming, BMX, all the information is really so easy to attain now, not like when we were little. So, I mean, really just getting a bike and just pedaling around, you're going to meet people. You go to any random skate park and there's just going to be people there you can meet and ride with. It was pretty cool. Like, a lot of the people that I met in high school, it was just, even a lot of people that I know and hang out with now has just literally all been from bikes. Maybe my buddy Joe at Random Fab, I got a surface grinder from him off Craigslist. I met him I found some guy selling just old shitty surface grinder that looked like it was in a fire. And, so he works for the fire department. And, so he's does inspections and finds these machines all the time. And, So he got this old surface grinder, and I started talking to him. He's like, yeah, a couple hundred bucks, you know. And he was in Orange, so he was right down the street from me. And I go over to his house, and he opens up the garage, and I see a BMX bike hanging from his ceiling.
Wow.
I'm like, dude, you ride? And he's like, yeah. So I stayed there for hours. Literally, I was over at his house for probably 4 hours just bullshitting about bikes and tools and all this other stuff. And he's like, you know what? Just take it. Just take it. Let me use it later, whatever, you know. We'll hang out. And ever since then, that was probably 6 years ago, 5-6 years.
Wow.
And we've been super close ever since. And yeah, I never thought I would meet a guy on Craigslist, but, you know, it worked out.
Hey, neither did a lot of us.
I'm sure guys meet guys on Craigslist every day.
Anal beads for sale.
Yeah, Albert.
So, I mean, really just like, yeah, like you were saying, just getting into stuff, really networking, you know, following the right people and just talking to people, interacting with people. And, you know, like with us at work, I know a lot of people are like, oh, how do I get into this job? Like, we're hiring, you know, you want to be a machinist? Come, we'll hire you tomorrow. We have plenty of work, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, it's out there. We hire a lot of people that come straight out of NTMA, which is good and bad. I mean, they have their feet wet, but they also get taught, it seems like, that they know everything when they graduate, you know? So you got a lot of kids coming in that think they know everything, but they don't even know how to calculate position, you know, which is kind of frustrating sometimes, but it's cool because you can tell. What's that?
I was going to say, do they come to you from NTMA with a certificate?
I don't see any of them, so I'm assuming that they do.
But, yeah, usually they come with their certificate.
They probably do, yeah.
They know everything when they come with a certificate.
Yeah, exactly. So, but we've got really good training programs and stuff. We do GD&T classes all the time that are really helpful for a lot of the guys that don't know it, or even some that think they know it. You know, they can brush up on it and get some real information.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it, you know, a lot of the course is coming directly from Y14.5, so there's really no BSing your way out of it. We've got inspectors at the shop that, you know, it's the same kind of thing. You know, even guys that have been around forever, still teaching them new things. The same in the shop. I mean, you never know everything. It doesn't matter how good you are. You know, that's what's cool about this industry is, like, you know, I'm probably 19 years or so in, and I'm still learning stuff all the time. Every shop that I've worked at has been just completely different. You know, sometimes you see, like, resumes where, oh, you've worked at 10 different shops. Why? You know, but also sometimes if somebody's been at a shop for a while and they kind of move around, you know, every 5 years or whatever, it's like maybe these guys are just getting bored, you know, and they want to learn some new stuff. So it's kind of, I think, kind of what happened with me too.
A little bit. You know, so, also sometimes, I mean, when you've been at a shop for a while and you've gotten better and you know your shit, I mean, in other people's defense, you can be headhunted to another shop where somebody will say, look, we're looking for like three good guys, you know, anybody.
Yeah.
And they'll come find you and they'll throw you $2 an hour, and you either make that decision or you don't, and you move to the next shop. And that's happened too.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's kind of what's nice too about my position is that, I mean, I love where I'm at. I like everybody there. It's great. But I have been headhunted since, because everybody knows I don't really have a shop anymore. You know, so I've had probably 5 solid offers at other shops, but a lot of it too is like, I don't want to relocate, you know, because my wife's family's down here and I don't want to pull my grandkid from her family.
Right.
So it's kind of tough, you know, so it's like, all right, I stay here, even though there's other opportunities that are better financially or, you know, benefits, whatever, you know, but it all kind of works out really well. I love where I'm at. We've got a really cool shop, a lot of cool machines, smart guys everywhere.
Yeah. And, what kind of machines you got in there, Ken? I mean, you didn't ask me that.
So the mill department is primarily Mori, Morisaki. All of our DMG Moris are unfortunately garbage. I think they sent us probably the worst machines they ever had, and then sent the worst techs that they've ever hired to work on them. So we've been kind of selling off of a lot of our DMG Mori stuff. But our old Morisakis, they're fucking awesome. I have never had any issues, or we really haven't had any major problems with those things. They just run like crazy. We've got 12 Brothers, 11 Speedios, and an old TC. In the mill department. So we've got one horizontal, it's a DMG NHX 4000, and then the 11 Speedios, we've got 700s, 500s, R450s, kind of a good little mix of each. For the mill department, our Swiss department's all star, and then lathe department is primarily Akuma.
Oh,
so yeah, so it's pretty cool. I don't really work in the lathe department at all. Like when I started, so I started there as a setup guy, and was doing that. I was doing a lot of the cool, like complex four axis stuff. and was one of kind of three or four main setup guys, and then everybody else's operators. We do a lot of high production stuff.
Okay.
We're like four to 600 parts a day on some part numbers. So we got pretty good quantities on everything. So we're running 3 shifts, 6 days typically, occasionally on Sundays. But about 155 guys between the 3 shops that we have. So we've got our shop here in just south of LA, and then where I'm at, we've got another shop in Mexicali, and then we just opened up a third shop in Morton Grove, just outside of Chicago. So I don't think it's very far from you.
Actually, okay, 155 people. That's a pretty decent sized shop.
Yeah, and that's total. That's everybody in the office. It's the sales guys. It's the temps. You know, but it's a pretty good amount. You know, we're running 3 shifts, and we turn a lot of product out. It's cool.
It sounds like it.
Definitely. So,
yeah, what kind of stars do you have there?
We've got a bunch. We've got some SR20s, SV32Js. We've got two of those, and we just ordered a third one. Should be here like the end of the year. We've got 9 stars right now. Wow. Pretty much like one of each. We've got all kinds of shit. So it's cool. Yeah, we do a lot of little stuff. We don't really do a whole lot of complex Swiss work, primarily just because the cam is lacking. Just the department, I think, could be a little bit stronger with that kind of stuff. You know, there's a lot of jobs that we run that can run on the Swiss. Like, I know for sure they can run on the Swiss because I've done it before, and I've done more complex stuff than that. At my first shop, like the first shop that I was at, they had a star. It was an SV32J2, and we had a seat of part maker, and I was there for 5 years, and like the last 2.5 years or so, I just pretty much took that machine over and did all the programming, all the setup, all the operation on that. Which was pretty cool. So, I mean, I'm familiar with the capabilities of these things.
Right.
So seeing a lot of the stuff that we run now, I think we do a lot of like fairly simple stuff. We do occasionally do some complex stuff, but primarily because the lack of good solid cam for Swiss, we don't really do it. And also we try and break a lot of stuff up too, where we'll do some of like a full sequence of certain features on one machine, and then it'll go to a second machine, finish up a little bit more, go to another one, finish up a little bit more. I'm not a huge fan of it, but we do get a lot of parts per hour doing that. So it has its benefits and, you know, some of its cons, because you can misload and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, yeah, the more handling that you have more room for error for sure.
Yeah, but the nice thing is too, when we do that, is that we can have one kind of lower skilled operator just running that part, and he only has to focus on certain features of that part. So he doesn't have to worry about the whole part. You know, there's sometimes where we got guys that are focusing on this real tight position while a wide open tolerance has been creeping out the past 200 parts, you know, because they're so focused on this one other little feature. So, I mean, it's kind of good like that. We weigh all that kind of stuff. You know, we'll do time studies on everything. And if we can combine stuff to get rid of a sequence and not affect parts per hour overall, then we'll do it. But, a lot of this stuff that we've been running too has been running for like 15 years. So that was kind of how I ended up. So I'm working in manufacturing, and I'm a manufacturing engineer at work now for my title. But I started as a setup guy there, and then running jobs that had been running for, you know, 15 plus years on some of these programs. And everything there is very solid. We run very reliable, solid programs. The other programmer there is great. He's got a very, very solid background in work holding and GD&T and all that, you know. So it was really nice starting there, because they have such a solid group of guys that work there. There's a shitload of stuff to learn. You know, even having my own shop, going there, I mean, there's just so much to pull from everybody that works there. It's cool. We have guys that are like, they've been there for 48 years. In the shop floor that are still running, you know, a lot of guys, probably a huge percentage of the guys have been over there for over 25 years.
Awesome.
It's cool. They got a pretty good culture. The owners are awesome. You know, we it's cool. I dig it over there for sure.
Guys hiring?
Yeah, always. Yeah, we actually need a good Swiss programmer if you're interested in moving down here.
Well, I don't know that I would call myself a good Swiss programmer, but how about the Akumas?
Send Hank.
Send Hank down.
Oh, shit. You don't want Hank down there, trust me.
Yeah.
He'll stir up some shit bad.
Fucking nobody wants Hank, man, I tell you.
Hey, you know what? Fuck you, Jody. Hank loves you. Why can't you love him? You are a fucking motherfucking Hank hater. You are. God damn. He's got feelings too, Jodis.
What's he doing
Son
right
of
now?
A bitch. I gave him the night off because I knew Jody was fucking riding a cotton pony and going to come after him hard.
Fucking poor guy.
Whatever, man. He tries his hardest.
So, Ken, we talked earlier that how you'd obviously influenced quite a few people, I think, that have followed you. I mean, who would you say is some of the biggest influences for you?
I mean, for sure, you guys, of course, and everybody else that I interact with, you know, online and that I work with. I don't know if there's one person in particular, because everybody kind of has their own stuff that's cool that I kind of try and take, you know, a little bit from. But I know, I mean, Kamal, I've always talked to Kamal for years since both of us really got on Instagram. I talk to him all the time. And you guys and everybody else, I mean, it's like I said, there's just a little bit from everybody that's cool. Nobody really in particular that I can name right off the bat. I should have had a list, but
it might have been a long list.
Yeah, it's a long list for sure, which is great. I mean, we got a really good. I think we got a pretty solid community on Instagram. There's always a couple bad apples, but they get weeded out pretty
Definitely.
Quick.
Definitely.
You know what though? But there's only one cool guy in this group right now that has one of your knives, right?
That's true.
Oh man, so you are such a dick bag. Like,
yeah, I'd say Tony's
I'm so jealous
at the
you have that knife. I'm so jealous you've got
top
that
of the list. Did you hear that,
Tony's
Joe?
At the top.
Oh, wait.
Are you sure Hank didn't pawn it?
No, shit. I don't think so.
Hank's got it in his barbecue vest. He's cutting up some steaks right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, buddy.
He's barbecue investing the shit out of it.
Yeah, no shit. Ken seen him sticking tri-tips and whatever else he could find. I'm wasting him in pictures of stuff, stabbing a burrito, stabbing a fucking steak, whatever. He's like, I'm just glad you're using it, dude. I use that thing all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I must admit, so it's quite amazing. Like I was saying, when I came to you, Ken, you know, and we had a knife, I was like, why the fuck would you want, like, just to have a knife all the time? But when someone gave me this knife, like I explained how I was just basically terrible at flicking it out, I literally carry that thing everywhere now. Like, and there's so many times I go, oh, shit, I can use my knife to do this, you know? It's just amazing how you get used to it being in your pocket.
Yeah, there's so many uses for it. I don't really carry folders all that often anymore. I've got a pretty cool box cutter that my buddy made that I got from him. Just a utility knife with a razor blade that I can swap out, which is actually cool because I don't give a shit about the blade. I can just chuck it or if you go somewhere and you got to go through security or whatever, you just chuck the blade and you can keep the rest of it. It's not like you have to get rid of the whole damn thing. If you forget it, like when you go to Disneyland and you park 3 miles away and you walk for 45 minutes and you forget you have a knife in your pocket.
I put mine in my shoe.
Yeah,
that same thing happened to me at Disneyland, and I was like, fuck, I don't want to like walk all the way back. And so I've hit it in my shoe.
Okay.
Nothing really in particular. I mean, I think really, like, you know, if there's any advice or anything, really just guys that are actually even just working in shops, I think the biggest thing that we really try and teach people is to just look at their parts. Just look at, do visual inspection on everything you do. I mean, if anybody can take anything, I think, away from this, is really just, I can't even stress how important just visual inspection is.
Yeah.
You know, you hear people talking about CMM this and that and everything, and which is cool, but mechanical inspection and visual inspection, I'll put that up any day against the CMM, really. So, and I think that's pretty important, I think. We had a guy at the shop recently. He was telling us about how he went into the take a shit at the shop. And he's in there and he's getting ready to wipe, and chips fell off of his shoulder somehow onto the toilet paper, and he just ripped himself open.
No,
like, dude,
no way.
Yeah.
So oh my God. You basically have just combined like two episodes in one.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah. He hears about that every day.
So, like, do they have to take him to the hospital?
No, he just.
You waited this long to tell us this?
Maybe that was the story he told us. I don't know. Maybe it was the beads. I'm not sure.
Yeah. He was bleeding from the bum. Oh, no. It was a chip that fell on the toilet paper. Yeah,
you know what? It was one of...
It wasn't the other guy.
It sounds pretty preposterous, really.
It was one of Boomer's faulty butt plugs that wasn't deburred properly.
Hey.
Every one of those visual inspection. It's all good.
With love.
With love. Are you sure you tumbled it?
Yeah, I give it a little kiss before I put it in the box.
Oh!
Okay, kia kora! And that is the end of episode 10. We want to thank Ken for being on our show today. Thank you, Ken, very much.
Woo! Yeah, of course.
Thanks bud.
Yeah, thank you, bro.
Okay, until next time, we'll see you later.
Later. Mahalo.